Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Today's guest is Chris Budd. Chris is the founder of Ovation Finance and author of The Eternal Business and the Financial Wellbeing book, and also founded the Institute for Financial Wellbeing. As a business coach, consultant, podcaster, and keynote speaker, Chris helps leaders explore employee ownership, financial wellbeing, and coaching skills to build businesses that last beyond their founders. So welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much.
So I think we wanted to explore the relationship between financial well-being and happiness. And I know we've already had a little discussion before this episode about whether or not there is actually a relationship and what that relationship looks like. But we're really rooting this in a survey that we've seen recently around UK workers now prioritizing financial well-being support over physical and mental health support from their employers. So just to provide some context, first of all, Chris, what does that tell us about the pressures that people are facing right now?
Yeah, look, I think financial well-being in the workplace generally means what I would call financial resilience. So the support that they tend to be looking at, I would imagine, would be managing debt, budgeting, and just having better with money, really. Now, which is great and very important, but for me, that's not financial well-being. For me, financial well-being is a much, much broader topic, which relates to anything about the relationship between money and happiness. So the relationship between financial well-being and happiness, I would say there isn't one. It's the same thing. The trouble is we tend to start in the wrong place. So if we're just helping people with managing their money, if we started instead on talking about happiness, then that would automatically help them to manage their money better. And I can talk about some examples of how that would work if you want me to.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. That's already piqued my interest. What is that connection?
So let me first talk a bit more about we're starting at the wrong place. My wife is from Northern Ireland, and there's an old joke in Ireland that if you get lost and you need directions and you stop by the side of the street, you wind your window down and there's a pedestrian walking along and you say to them, could you tell me how to get to so-and-so? They'd say, well, I wouldn't start from here. And I kind of think that a relationship between money and happiness is exactly like that. I talk about the three steps. There are three steps to creating a great financial plan, having a great relationship with money. And what you need to do is you need to start with step two. Now, step two is to ask, what's going to make me happy? What's going to give me well-being? If for the purposes of this conversation, if we use happy and sad for kind of momentary, how I feel now, and well-being long-term. Okay, so what's going to give me well-being? And the answer to that, and by the way, this isn't my opinions, there's masses of research, academic research from psychology, neuroscience, religion's been talking. Buddha worked all this 2,500 years ago, right? He went over trees. So there's nothing new here. We're just applying the knowledge about happiness and well-being to money, okay? So what's going to make me happy? And the answer to that is self-worth, right? We've got Maslow's hierarchy of needs we can apply into this as well. We know that well-being comes from having a life with meaning and purpose, and it comes from having internal self-worth rather than external self-worth. And let me explain a bit more about that by an analogy with the classic trope of wealth, the yacht, right? Suppose somebody wants a yacht, and they may go to their financial advisor and they say, I want a financial plan that will help me be able to get a yacht. What the financial advisor should then do is to say, what is the yacht for? Because if the yacht is to go down to your local wealthy sailing club so that you can be around other wealthy people and sit on the back at 6 o'clock with a martini and be seen by everybody, your sense of self-worth only occurs as long as somebody is looking at you. When somebody isn't looking at you anymore, that yacht isn't going to be giving you any self-worth. If, on the other hand, you want that yacht because you go down to your local sailing club where you've been a member for 40 years and that's what you do, and that's where your friends are. When your adult kids come home, you all go out sailing for the day. That's a much more internal form of self-worth. So the answer to the step two is happiness comes from quality of social relationships, having meaning and purpose in life, which all adds up to internal self-worth. So we then get to step three. And step three is, what does that mean for me? So a life of meaning and purpose for you is going to be very different than it might be for me. So we need to work that out, the process I call know thyself from the old Greek Delphic maxims. Know thyself, understand what makes you happy and what's going to give you well-being. And try and ignore all the things that are pushing you to say, more money, status, because that's a false happiness. That's only very short term. So we work out what makes us, what gives us well-being. We work out what that does for us, how that applies to us. And then now we can go back to step one, which is create financial plans. But what we all tend to do in this society is we start off with the financial plan. We start off trying to get financial independence. We start off trying to build up some wealth. And only when we've got it do we then look around and say, great, now how can I use this to be happy? So we're starting at the wrong place. We should be starting at that second point of understanding well-being, not just how to manage money and how to create wealth.
Amazing. So then how does your employment or whatever you do to earn money play? How does this that fit into this? Because obviously that has a role as more than just a generator of income. It also has a role and a contributor to the broad sense of happiness as well. So how do you look at that in that context?
So we've got to be realistic here, right? I can talk to you about the theory, but and about having meaning and purpose. And I would answer about things like making sure that your job has meaning to you, and that the company you work for shares the same values that you have. But yeah, we can't always do that, can we? You know, sometimes we've got to do a job to pay the mortgage, to pay the rent. So we have to be realistic. But in theory, at least, as much as possible, one should find a job with a company whose values match your own values. To create financial plans with your money, which, by the way, financial plans sounds big and grand. It could just be putting tenner away a month to build up an emergency fund, which is a really, really important part of well-being. So make sure that you are working for a company whose values align with yours, and that you're using your money from that in a way that will make you happy, that will build well-being for you.
Do you find in your dealing with clients that come to you to talk to you about well-being, do you find that often the relationship they have with money is actually contributing to unhappiness? So it's not just that they're not achieving their own version of financial well-being and pursuing their own definition of happiness, but actually that they are, the relationship is causing them some sort of ill effect as well.
Yeah. Every single time, I would say.
Right.
Our relationship with money in our Western society is based on the assumption that more is better. Advertising exists to make us unhappy in order that we think we want to have the thing that is being advertised, that without it, I'm not the person I should be. You know, everything around us, success, you just Google the word success and you will see wealthy people. And yet we know, the research tells us, that the relationship between money and happiness is that money does make a difference. Again, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you go to a homeless person and give them enough money for a flat, of course they will be happier. So we mustn't be patronizing and say there's no relationship between money and happiness. But at the same time, have you ever met an unhappy Buddhist monk? You know, and they specifically believe that having things is the source of unhappiness. Now, I don't want to be a Buddhist monk. I don't want nothing. I've got a big record collection and I like collecting records, right? So that makes me happy. But I can afford that and it doesn't cause me financial problems. So that's where this know thyself thing comes in, is to spend time working out what all this means to you. What makes me happy? Now, there's two aspects to this. There's what's true of everyone and there's what's true of you. So, for example, we know that the quality of social relationships I've mentioned, that can be community. It's worth people spending time thinking on their giving. That can be a tenner a month to the Red Cross or whoever, or it could be about getting involved with your local community. One of the things, so allocating your time as well as your money, because community involvement is known to be a good contributor towards well-being.
A little dog entered over here as well, but she's in fact ignored me and she's gone for the little one tiny blade of sun that's on the carpet. She's having a sunbathe.
There you go. Dogs know about well-being, don't they? I mean, they just get in that.
Don't they? Like, if Pep's got a tennis ball, food and a human nearby, she's there happy, that girl.
And if you gave them a job and a salary and told them they could have a bigger ball if they worked harder, they would be unhappy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really good illustration of the point.
Yeah.
We know that having meaning and purpose in your life, quality of social relationships, is a really big contributor to well-being. So being involved with your local community is a really big part of that. Going more than just doing your job, getting involved. So I, and I'll qualify this statement, but I'm one of the UK's experts in employee ownership trusts, EOTs. And I'll qualify that because I say I'm one of the UK's experts. There's only about five of us. who are experts in the small business world. And a big part of turning on the power of employee ownership is connecting employees' own values with their business values. And that means your business values need to be really, really clearly expressed. Not mission statements, not we are innovative, because that doesn't mean anything at all. But really, what do you exist for? What's the purpose of your company?
So I wanted to just return back to your point at the beginning when we started talking about employers. So as you said, and I think it's a really important point, that often employers think of financial well-being as resilience, so budgeting, debt, pensions, things like that. And you've obviously defined it quite differently. Do you think that employers have a responsibility to think more broadly about the financial well-being of their employees? Or would the world be a better place if they did? What's your perspective on that?
I would say both. It's hard to speak about moral responsibility of employers. I have been an employer. You know, I ran a financial planning business for 20 years. And I found that if my employees were more connected to the purpose of the business and the clients and the outcomes of clients, they were happier and they worked better and we made more money. So that's not just the moral imperative. It's better for productivity. So let me explain a bit more about why I think financial well-being. It's not that it's different definition. It's broader. So there are five pillars of financial well-being, and one of them is control of daily finances. Another is the ability to cope with financial shocks, right? Now, both of those are financial resilience. It is in there. You know, it is important. But we also have having a clear path to identifiable objectives. So there's two parts to that. The clear path is having some sort of a plan, and the identifiable objectives is that know thyself stuff that I was talking about. So it's not that it's different. It's that it's broader. Financial well-being encompasses financial resilience, but it's much broader than that. So can I talk about another aspect of happiness that will illustrate why I think it's really important that we don't just talk about financial resilience? There's one well-known model of well-being, which is called set point theory. Now, set point theory says that we go through life with a set level of well-being. It doesn't tend to change long term. So, for example, there was one survey many, many years ago in the 70s, I think, where a load of people who had won the lottery and a load of people who had lost a limb or more in an accident were surveyed about their well-being before and after that life-changing event. And the survey suggested that their level of well-being didn't change. Obviously, there's a period of adjustment, but the level of long-term well-being was not affected by winning the lottery or having a life-changing, you'd think, accident. So we have the set level of well-being and we oscillate around it. So it comes back to that thing of the definitions of well-being and happy and sad. So something might happen and it makes us feel happy, so it pushes us up above our set level of well-being. And then we get used to that thing that made us happy. We wake up next day and we're back at our level. Or something that happens and makes us sad, and then we go back and acclimatize and we get back to that set level. Now, if something makes us happy, well, obviously, that's nice. We're not going to want to change that. But if something makes us sad, we don't like that very much. So we want to do something about it. So what do? We buy stuff. There's even a name for it, retail therapy, right? Retail therapy is not a good thing. It's about spending short-term hits of happiness to keep us up to our long-term set level of well-being. What's really interesting, so that for me, if people understood that, they automatically improve their spending habits. My spending habits have improved massively since I started working on this 10 years ago. One of the ways my habits have improved is I still buy records because I like it, right? And I've worked out that it's important to me to carry on doing that. Whereas I don't really buy many other stuff, like status stuff that I don't really need. Now, the really interesting bit for me of set point theory is to ask, where does our set point come from? Because we're all different. You probably know somebody who's just happy being miserable, right? And you probably also...
Chris, since you said that in our discovery call, I've quoted it so many times. And then light bulbs when I've been like, oh! You're one of those people.
We can all think of somebody, can't we? And then you've got people who just kind of, they walk into a room and everybody just feels a bit better, right? So we've all got our own set level of well-being. Where does that come from? The research suggests, this is an American researcher called Sonia Lyubomirsky, the research suggests that 50% of it is in your DNA. It's inherited. which I think is
interesting. Yeah.
You'd have thought it's childhood experiences, but that's not what the research suggests. 50% of it is in your DNA. Another 10% of it is your circumstances. So how much you're worth, where you live, and so on. And then the other 40% is how you react with money, how you relate, your actions. It's your choice. So that means if all we're doing is focusing on the money, we're only focusing on 10% of what makes us happy. The circumstances. So if you improve somebody's financial resilience by, not financial, improve their financial position by 50%, their overall well-being will increase by just 5%. If you also spend time helping them with their interactions and how they live, their attitude to money, their financial well-being, their relationship with money, then, and that improves by 50%, then their overall well-being will increase by 25%. So if we're just talking about money, we're looking at the wrong place. So that's why I think what I see most of the stuff going on in the workplace is, for me, insufficient. It's not bad. It's not wrong. Some of it's great. It's just not enough. And it's starting at the wrong place.
Yeah. And what does it feel like? Like if I'm in a place of great financial well-being, how am I moving through my day to day? What am I worried about, not worried about? What does it feel like beyond just a sort of general sense of happiness?
I would say the main thing is that you're not thinking about money.
Yeah.
And do you encounter a lot of people like that, Chris, in your line of work?
All the time. So there's one chap who was a client. I've obviously changed all the circumstances, but it is a real person. They had recently come into quite a lot of money and they had £5 million in their current account, right? And when I started coaching this person, they described themselves as bereft. Would you feel bereft with £5 million in your current account? The reason that they were bereft was because they'd had a big change in their life and the thing that defined them had changed. And this can happen at retirement, for example. You work hard, you get financial independence, you get retirement, you start working, you go, great, now what shall I do? And you realize that actually the thing that made me feel really good in life was what I did before I retired. I had a team of people that I related to. I was probably quite good at what I did. I could see the point of what I did. Now I'm sitting at home and I don't know what to do anymore. Oh, I'll go out and play golf or I'll go traveling. Well, that's great. But when you come back from golf or you come back from traveling, you've still got that feeling. Yeah, lack of purpose. So I come across that sort of thing all the time. Look, one really good tip, how to get rich quick. How to get rich quick. Write a book called How to Get Rich Quick. There are so many books out there giving people hints and tips on how to save money. The books that talk about money and happiness start off with talking about money. There's not very many books out there that talk about happiness first. But if you spend your time looking at what makes us happy, you realize you didn't need as much money as you thought you did. So that person who had that £7 million in their current account could well have stopped work many, many years previously and done the things that they enjoyed. As it happened, he did enjoy what he was doing. But nevertheless, let me give you another quick story. A chap who was an accountant working in London. He was the managing director of the fairly large firm. He was a client of ours of Ovation, and he was living in London four nights a week and coming back to see his family at the weekend, two young kids. And when I met him, he was quite unhappy because he was working hard and earning, you know, many hundreds of thousands of pounds. He was very, very highly paid, but he didn't get to see his kids. So never got to tuck his kids into bed other than the weekend, never got to walk them from school or pick them up from school. So we did some financial planning, some cash flow forecasting for him and showed him that he already had financial independence. He just never stopped to look at it. And so we asked him, well, what do you actually want to do? What would make you happy? You know, what employment? Do you like being a managing director of an accountancy firm? Not really. He said he wanted to be a history teacher. So he didn't have enough money to stop work, but he did have enough money that he could take a much lower salary. So he retrained to be a history teacher. These are the sorts of things that you could do when you start off by thinking about what makes me happy and what will give me meaning and purpose and et cetera. And the importance of social relationships, family, and so on.
So we obviously find ourselves in a context where things have become much more expensive, right? So there are certain things, macro issues that are happening out in the world that are impacting people's financial situation. Certainly mine. I have a good amount of financial well-being, or I felt that I did for quite a long time, pursuing a job that gives me gratification and purpose, and by and large, feeling pretty good. As a consequence of a variety of different things happening out in the world, I now am much more aware of the fact that I have a lot less money to spend, things are more expensive, and so on, which I'm sure is the experience felt more acutely or less acutely, depending on where people sit, but is the experience of most people. So what is your advice to people in those moments? How do you reassess and figure out how you adjust and adapt?
Can I add a few stats into there before Chris answers? So when doing some research for this, so latest research from Money and Pension Service highlights that 22% of people have less than £100 savings, 60% of adults are struggling to keep up with bills, 17% have to borrow money to pay for food and bills. So that's it's real, right? So I just wanted to add those in. What's your take on Alice's question?
So I do appreciate, it's a very, very valid question. I do appreciate the examples that I've had personally. As a financial planner, I tended to deal with wealthier people. Mm. And therefore, the examples that I give can be of that in that category. But the principles are exactly the same. So the stuff you're buying, do you need it? I don't mean do you want it, but do you need it? So there's kind of several levels of spending habits. And it's boring as hell, but it's a really good practice to go through your bank account and say to yourself, did that thing bring me joy? There was a big thing about this a few years ago with Marie Kondo and had a TV show on it. I loved it. I think it's very, very valid. I did it for in my house, but do it on spending. So that question, what is it for? Is a really good question. So I've got lots of records. I've got a few guitars. I play guitars. And I'm always wanting another guitar. You know, it was one of the rules in life. You never sell a guitar. But I've stopped buying guitars. I mean, I've got about four. It's not like I've got hundreds. But, you know, go to a new town. And my wife will say, oh, there's a music shop over there with guitars. Do you want to go and have a look? And I don't anymore. Because I know that guitar, if I buy another one, it'll be nice for the moment. Then I'll get it back and I'll put it in its case. And I'm probably won't look at it for 6 months. Well, what's the point in that? So I don't buy it. So there's a few good tips to this, right? We need to fool ourselves, right? We like our enjoyment now, not later. We don't like putting off well-being. In fact, remind me to talk about future self, because there's some great theory about why that happens. It's just a fact that if you give somebody a choice of spending money now or spending money in 2 years' time, they will spend money now to enjoy it. So we have bad habits. Behavioral finance is a really big part of financial well-being. We've all got poor relationship with money. We've all got poor behaviors. So we need to fool ourselves. And the way we can do this is by putting in certain plans and techniques and automation. So, for example, direct debit, regular savings into a bank account, standing order into your bank account, a savings account, so you've got some emergency funds. Could be a fiver a month, could be a tenner a month, something, make it automated so that you can't spend it. The delay factor. So when my kids were little, they might walk past a toy shop and see a thing of Legos. I want that Lego. And I would say, I tell you what, you can have that Lego if you ask me for it again in 2 weeks' time. And of course, very, very rarely would they remember. But if they did and said, Dad, you consider I can have that Lego. Okay. You clearly actually really want it. Then you can have it as long as we can afford it. So think of yourself and your impulses to buy as that little kid. You need to trick yourself. Buying something on Amazon, put it in a basket. This is what I do. I put it in a basket and then I leave it for a couple of days. And I go back and go, well, you really want that? Actually, no, I don't. And I probably delete half the stuff I put in my basket.
This works very well with cake as well, the second piece of cake.
I think it's worth remembering at all times where we live in a society which is entirely built around making us consume. So this is an extreme, but this is quite fun. But it is true. When I go to the cinema, I go to the movies quite a lot with my son when he was at home, and he would go in to see the trailers and the adverts, and I sit outside. And he texts me, and I read a book for 20 minutes. And he texts me when the film's about to start, and then I'd run in and I'd take the seat. I love my cricket. I'll sit and watch cricket, or we'll sit and watch telly. I have the remote control in my hand or next to ad at all times. And you've never seen anybody mute the adverts as fast as I can. Honestly, I probably haven't seen a whole advert for about 20 years because I know it is trying to force me to buy stuff I don't actually need. And this is all our advertising is everywhere. Social media, what you see on social media, on Facebook of people's lives isn't real. There's a great quote from Theodore Roosevelt that comparison is the thief of joy. And we only ever tend to compare upwards. We don't often compare downwards and think how lucky we are for what we've got. We only ever tend to compare upwards. So these are all habits that are just part of our daily lives. That if we become aware of them by understanding more about the sources of joy and well-being in life, we're far more likely to be able to improve our habits, improve our relationship with money, and therefore be happier. And that is irrespective of how much you earn and how much you're worth.
For your listener, you said about, you know, direct debits, automations and things like that. My partner and I did this to just like a reset because, you know, life sweeps you along, right? We went through our bank accounts and deleted the subscriptions that we'd done together over time. And between us, we eradicated, I think it was about 300 quid a month.
Wow.
On various subscriptions. And we were stunned, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just a little thing. So you go, oh, a little odd, $7.99 here. And just you sign up to things, then you're like, I'll cancel it. You know, never get around to cancel it.
There's also the, as I say, businesses know this now. Businesses know this, that they are actively trying to make us do stuff we don't want to do to spend money. So an example is a friend of mine's father died and he had a obituary in the Telegraph that I wanted to read. And I don't subscribe to a Telegraph, so I couldn't read it. So I subscribed, 7-day free trial. Am I going to forget to stop that free trial becoming a paid subscription? Probably. I mean, I didn't because I'm obviously very aware of it, but lots of people will do that. So yeah, great tip.
There's obviously a lot of new tools that can go in and crawl your bank accounts and tell you what you're spending on what. And I've got about four or five things that take the final P off the pound and throw it somewhere. Are there things that you really buy into or recommend to your clients on the regular that they should be integrating?
So I'm going to sound like a bit of an old fuddy-duddy here. And this kind of, you know, we're not going to get into the topic of AI, but I've written 6 books, 3 novels. We have a financial well-being podcast. I've written hundreds of scripts for that. I learn from the process of work. So yeah, there may well be an app that can give you all of that, but you won't learn much from that. Much better is to, I mean, literally print your bank statement out onto a piece of paper and spend the time. It's boring as hell. Honestly, I know it is. I know this is painful, but go together. And if you're in a relationship together, and ask each other, what was that one for? You know, be honest. We could get a whole thing about financial issues with couples. But understand what you're spending. And is your spending bringing you well-being as well as happiness? Remembering that well-being is long-term happiness in the instant. What are your objectives? Have a financial plan. The first financial well-being book has all about creating your own financial plan. And if you can afford to get a financial planner who'll do cash flow forecast, cracking. If not, that book will help you do a simplified version yourself. That financial plan, that clear path to identifiable objectives, right? If you spent time on the identifiable objectives, the know thyself, and you've worked out, if I can just put this much away, then I can change my job to be a history teacher in 7 years' time. You know, or example I always love to give is a chap who I dealt with who stopped working at a bank 5 years earlier than his retirement age in order to make stained glass windows, because that was his hobby, something creative. Lots of people never get the chance to be creative. If you can see that future, you are far more likely to make a better decision with your money now to fool your current self in favor of your future self.
So I'm assuming you see a lot of people like me who can be a bit head in the sand about money and somehow and get in these patterns where we're very well intentioned, filling in the spreadsheets and then just sort of drift away from those habits and tend to just turn my back on it and ignore it for a bit, which obviously creates problems. Are there other similar types of behaviors that you see regularly that you have to help unpick from the start?
My goodness me, yes. So the second book is called The Four Cornerstones of Financial Wellbeing. And I've mentioned the two of them, which is the things that are true of all of us. And then there's how that applies to each of us about the positive things to make us happy. And then there's the other two are the negative side. So the behaviors that are true of all of us and the behaviors that are true of each of us. Now, in that last category, we would call those self-limiting beliefs. So very often you would see somebody would say, well, the stock market isn't for me. Now, that's not a truth. Really, really important thing to this was a big change in my life when this dawned on me that just because I believe something doesn't mean that it's true, right? Just because I might have believed that staying in the European Union would have been the right thing for the country doesn't mean that it's true. Equally, somebody who believes that exiting the European Union is the best thing for the country, you've no idea, really. It's okay to have those beliefs, but as long as you know that they're not truths. So I might hear somebody who say, oh, I'm not very good with money, or the stock market isn't for me. These aren't reality. These are just things that you believe, and they can be therefore changed. So those are two quite common ones. And then there's the behaviours that are true of all of us would be things like loss aversion. We don't like losing stuff. So there's some research done by a brilliant friend of mine called Neil Bage that suggests that we feel the loss of something 3.5 times more than its equivalent gain. So if you imagine you lose a bag with your money in it, right? Oh, man, got to change your credit card, got to change your debit card. So annoying. A day later, I left it behind the sofa. It fell down the back of the sofa. That's nice, but it's nowhere near as bad as a feeling as when you lost it. So loss aversion is true of everybody, and it's there because it stopped you from being eaten by a saber-toothed tiger 5,000 years ago, right? These things are built into us for good reason, but they don't always end up leading to good financial decisions. So loss aversion could mean that you might have some money in the stock market, and we all have, whether we like it or not, by your pension or what have you, and you might see that your money's gone down a little bit. You don't like that, so you cash out. Well, that's the worst thing you could do is cash out at the bottom. Supposed to cash out at the top, not the bottom. But if you look at the inflows and outflows of the stock market, when there's a stock market crash, there's a huge amount of money taken out of the stock market at the very worst possible time because of this loss aversion. There's loads and loads. Psychologists have identified something like 250 different cognitive and behavioral biases around money. So there's so much. Right. There's so much. And that comes back to that set point theory about that 40%, our interactions with money and our attitude to money. That is all the 250 of them that we need to work on one at a time.
If going back to the employer-employee relationship, so I've worked in a business where they brought in I think it was a mortgage advisor, actually, because they're quite specific, because obviously financial well-being is so broad, a lunch and learn, and it was one of the most best attended events that they've had, because they used to do a lot around people and culture. And it just made me think, you know, why doesn't this happen more? You know, we're not taught about mortgages, et cetera, in school. And we've had topics around education on the pod, and you know, people saying the education system is broken. Why aren't we taught about financial planning, mortgages, or all of that type of stuff? What do you think organizations should be doing to support employees, which will then obviously help and impact stress, et cetera?
Look, the whole financial education, particularly in schools, is massive. I couldn't agree with you more. But there's reasons for that. The government approach to schooling tends to be that they see students as economic units, and they've got to get them ready to be productive in the world. That's, you know, that was an actual phrase used by a government minister a few years ago. So there isn't the political will to bring financial education into the schools. So there are lots of financial advisors who go into schools and give talks for free, much maligned profession, financial advisors. There's a lot of people doing a lot of pro bono work on that. But I come back to my I wouldn't start from here point. It all tends to be what is an ISA, what is a pension, how does compound interest work? And therefore, we're starting at the wrong place. So What I would want to see is the financial well-being workshops and education that's done in the workplace to start with the stuff that I've been talking about today, to start with what's going to make you happy as you go through life. Now, let's apply that to money so that people have a better relationship with money. Look, MAPS is great. I'm a big fan of the Money and Pension Service, but they just talk about money. Same thing is most of the money help books that you get just talk about money, and we should be talking about happiness. I've got a draft of a book written, which hasn't found a publisher yet, which is called How Employee Ownership Will Save Humanity.
Yeah, well, then you do feel quite strongly about this.
I do. I really do.
Yeah.
So just briefly to explain, anybody who knew how John Lewis's John Lewis's own. It's owned by a trust fund, and the employees are called partners, and they get the benefit of the profit from the trust fund. So employee ownership trusts is, it was brought in by the Liberal Democrat part of the coalition government at that time in 2014. It was created a new suite of documents to enable this to happen for small businesses. I sold my business, Ovation Finance, to an employee ownership trust back in 2018. And what it means is that the ownership of the company is taken away from one or two individuals, the bosses, you know, and given to or sold to, it's not given, it's a commercial arrangement, sold for a commercial value to a trust fund whose beneficiaries are the employees. Okay, so that means two things if it's done right. Firstly, they should get the benefit of profit from the business going forwards once the owner has been paid out, and there's a whole mechanism around that. And secondly, they should have a voice in the business. They should feel that they are now owners. They don't actually own shares, so they're what's called indirect owners as beneficiaries of the trust, but they should feel like owners. That takes quite a lot of work, and that's what we do to help businesses get ready for that. Quite a lot of businesses have just been put straight into employee ownership trusts for tax reasons and haven't done some of this stuff. And they tend to run into problems, and we help some of those. When it's done right, it's really powerful, because people like Ovation, the employees of Ovation love working there because they feel that they have a voice in the business. It's their business, you know. Really powerful stuff.
What's one piece of financial advice that you either hear often that you despise, or that you've heard yourself and you'd had to unlearn?
Well, look, there's lots of great financial advice in literature. There's Dickens. What does Mr. Micawber say? I can't remember what it is. Do you remember that one? It's something like, income 2 shillings, outgoings 1 shilling good, income 2 shillings, outgoing 3 shillings bad, something like that, you know. But it's true. It holds true today. Get a hold of your spending and do things, as Danielle said, look, check your subscriptions. There's some really simple stuff that you can do. I think one that I don't think I've got one that I really don't like, but there is an approach that I really don't like. And that is behavioural changes. See a lot of, anybody that's into this stuff, there's a lot of literature out there about behavioural finance and how our behaviours relate to money. And a lot of the time you see people tell you how to have better behaviours in order to beat investment markets. That drives me nuts. For me, it's like learning to play the piano in order to break it up for firewood. It's just missing the point by such a wide mark. Let's have better relationship with money, not to beat markets, but so that we can be happier. What's the point otherwise? You know, the whole objective of life is well-being. That's why we're here, to create joy. And by the way, here's a good tip. This is my favorite tip. And if anybody wanted to read one book as a result of this, obviously I would say it should be one of mine. But actually, there's an even better one than mine, which is called The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. They got together for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday and talked about what is joy. There's also a TV kind of film that was on Netflix, so if you want to get your information that way. But the book goes much deeper, and it's absolutely wonderful. And if you want to know the secret to happiness, kindness. That's it.
Simple.
You could just keep that word in your head and nothing else, and think about your spending in that context, and you will be happier, and you'll probably be spending less money and have a better relationship with money. It's the best way of summing it up was the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who said, "Joy is your reward for the giving of joy." Isn't that a great phrase?
Yes, lovely. So obviously people can find your books, and what are the best ways to find those? Where can people learn more about you?
Go and ask Jeff Bezos, unfortunately. That's probably the easiest way.
We're all complicit.
We are, aren't we? They've got us by the short. They're all on Amazon. There's also the Financial Wellbeing Podcast. We've got 120 episodes. Been doing that for about 10 years, which covers all of this stuff in really great detail. That's probably the best kind of things. If there's any financial planners listening to this or financial coaches, then the Institute for Financial Wellbeing, Google that and have a look at their work as well.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks so much. Lots of really useful advice there, and lots of big things to think about as well. So we really appreciate
you
being
Chris.
Here in your time.
Thank you for
your time. And thank you, Luna.
Yes. Great contributor. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.